This is Going Negative, a podcast about solving climate change through carbon dioxide removal.
Welcome to Going Negative. I'm Tom Green. And today I'm joined by Amanda Ravenhill, who is the Executive Director of the Buckminster Fuller Institute. Amanda has an incredibly interesting background in a variety of aspects of climate change, including founding the Biochar Association, Hero Hatchery, Project Drawdown, and as I mentioned, is now Executive Director of the Buckminster Fuller Institute. So welcome to the show, Amanda.
Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
Yeah, my pleasure. So let's just start with, how did you get into this world of climate action? Love to hear your story a little bit.
Thanks. I'd say it starts with my parents. My parents are anthropologists, and I was able to grow up in many different countries around the world. I was born in Abidjan, which is the capital of Cote d'Ivoire, Ivory Coast, and also went to high school in Bolivia, spent some time in Haiti. And that kind of gave me a planetary perspective. I've always kind of been able to see things from multiple perspectives at once, kind of, you know, translate between worldviews. And so I think I just, you know, things hit me in a different way. So when I found out about climate change and just how dire it was, it really, I could like just see kind of the writing on the wall, what that meant for so many people around the world. Just fast forward to working with 350.org and being in Copenhagen in 2009 and hearing the African youth delegation chanting through the hall 1.5 to stay alive, referencing 1.5 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial levels. We have to stay below that in order for so many people in sub-Saharan Africa and around the world in order to have a thrivable future. Backing up into my history, I also spent all my summers in Maine on a little island, and sea level rise is apparent there. You can see it on the coasts. Whenever there's a high tide storm surge, we see massive erosion. And it's just my favorite place that I found in the whole spaceship Earth, and the thought of it being washed away is just... breaks my heart totally. So that, in addition with being on the front lines in Bolivia with some landslides and just like seeing the extreme weather for myself and seeing so much of the beauty and, you know, life that we've created in this world, getting literally like washed away is what drives me, you know, to protect it and ensure that we can continue to have beauty.
Thank you for sharing that. And Spaceship Earth, of course, a reference there to Buckminster Fuller. You've seen the effects of climate change with your own eyes all around the world. That must have been quite the emotional roller coaster for you. What have been some of those emotionally for you on this whole journey?
Yeah. So when I was living in Bolivia, I went there after college to work on this great fair trade handicraft program. And, you know, it was like this awesome fair trade, you know, economic development program, all using natural fibers and materials and, you know, regenerating local landscapes by growing grasslands and all sorts of incredible, beautiful things. And literally to see climate change wash away the foundation of some of the homes of the women I was working with, I was like, okay, no matter all of the things that we do, this complex, you know, equation on how to make humanity thrive and all life thrive, climate change is this, you know, kind of multiplier. And if we don't deal with it, it'll just make all of that so much harder. And that was a really low. And I realized several years later that it works the other way, that if we deal with climate change well and anticipate the knock-on effects, you know, the second order effects, then we can ensure that we have cascading benefits and we can heal all of those things at the same time. So that kind of both sides of the climate multiplier have been low lows and high highs for me.
So let's talk about the climate multiplier, as you call it, or some of the cascading benefits of positive action to address climate change. What are some examples of that?
Yeah, so we like to, when we started using the term at drawdown, this idea of cascading benefits. So not just co-benefits of, you know, just looking at, say, when you sequester carbon through photosynthesis, there is water retention. You know, it's not just that. It's really looking at these virtuous reinforcing feedback loops where there's water retention. And so actually having healthier water makes a more resilient landscape to extreme weather, and kind of really looking at the full cycle of flows of these kind of knock-on effects. And so one of the solutions from Drawdown is empowering women smallholder farmers and ensuring that they have the resources they need to use their traditional practices and, you know, improve the biodiversity and the health of the soil. And what that does is it enables more nutrient-dense food. And when people have more nutrient-dense food, they're more able to, you know, thrive and function. And then that more nutrient-dense food can also, and again, with higher income, they can grow more nutrient-dense food. So there's all these kind of reinforcing loops that higher income can lead them to educating their children better and having more resources for their kids. And then also when women have higher income, they tend to invest it more in their community, which helps with small and medium-sized enterprises and, you know, like local economic churn instead of money just going to, you know, big multinational corporations and feeding the inequality that is strangling the world. So there's kind of this cascade of benefits that kind of mimics how ecosystems work. You know, there's not just a food chain, it's really a food web. And there's so many beautiful kind of like mutually causal loops that you find in nature. And I think as we're designing climate solutions, it makes a lot of sense to kind of look to nature as inspiration and see how we can really enhance the rhythms and the kind of what Buckminster Fuller called the eternally regenerative universe. The kind of base state of nature is to be regenerative. And humans are uniquely positioned to be able to accelerate that regeneration.
That's very, very inspiring. I love it. One thing that comes up for me there is, you know, like it or not, we're living in a world economy that is primarily driven by capitalism, and the part of what you talked about there was solutions to climate change, which not only have knock on ecological benefits, but also have knock on economic benefits, and certainly seems like that could be a win-win, right? If you can, it's one thing to ask people to pay to address climate change. It's another to tell people that actually, if we address climate change, then you're going to create economic growth at the same time.
Yeah. And there's also political security, food security. There's so many elements to having healthy ecosystems. You know, if you look at all the different forms of capital, social capital, cultural capital, they can all be increased by really focusing on enhancing the potential of living systems to take care of everything in them, including humans.
Super cool. Are there any other projects that have those kind of characteristics beyond the one you mentioned that you're excited about for the future?
Yeah, so Buckminster Fuller Institute has launched a new program called Regenerosity. We've partnered up with a couple other organizations that were both running prize programs and identifying regenerative projects around the world. And so with Lush Cosmetics and the UNDP Equator Prize, all told, we have over 700 projects that we've vetted, high integrity regenerative projects around the world in over 75 countries. And we're raising a fund and also building a network of these solutions. And so we just actually closed our first million, secured our first million of the fund, which will focus. Thank you. Yeah, it'll focus on regenerative agriculture projects for now in East Africa, India, and Ecuador. And yeah, super excited to be able to work alongside. A lot of them are kind of regenerative agriculture hubs that work with a variety of smallholder farmers. And yeah, to work alongside them to kind of make a global plan to say, how can we reward land stewards for, you know, ecosystem services and ecosystem function that they're increasing. And so we're actually partnering with Regen Network in order to kind of develop some methodologies to enable agroforestry stewards to be able to, you know, gain benefit for building up their local biome, the microbiome in the soil, and also just the biodiversity and life that thrives in agroforestry systems. If you look at Project Drawdown, which was my last nonprofit, agroforestry is actually the top solution to climate change if you add up all of the various agroforestry solutions that we put into the book, including silvopasture and multi-strata agroforestry and looking at perennial staple crops and some others. So very excited about those projects. And a lot of the projects in Ecuador specifically are run by indigenous people. And there's just such a beautiful story in the, you know, the Amazon being largely planted by humans and kind of going back to remembering that we can be a beneficial species, that humans can create more ecosystem function than take ecosystem consumption.
I'd love to hear more about that. The Amazon, mostly planted by humans, and of course, as everybody knows, there's been a lot of deforestation there. Talk to me a little bit more about the Amazon, some of the history there, and what you see as the possibilities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I got super excited about biochar in 2009. And part of the reason for that is because there's this soil in the Amazon called terra preta, dark earth. And Charles Mann wrote about it in 1491. it's essentially this soil that has been built up by humans by adding biochar, which is biological charcoal added to soil that basically acts as like a coral reef for the soil, like a habitat for microorganisms. And healthy soil contains lots of microorganisms, so it's good to have them living somewhere. And so the terra preta has biochar. It also has ceramics in it, fish bones, compost. And in some places, the terra preta is still growing 3 inches a year because it's so alive. So in terms of a carbon sink and our ability to kind of bio-geoengineer this conundrum kerfuffle of a carbon cycle that we're in the midst of right now, I just think it's so exciting to learn from the Amazon. And the reason that soil is there is because humans were there for, you know, at least 10 millennia, maybe more, adding to the soil and living in right relationship with the soil and the air and the water cycles, and really appreciating biodiversity. So there's so much to get into in the Amazon. But, you know, just thinking about the carbon cycle, we have an excess trillion tons in the atmosphere right now. And there's just so much potential to sequester that into these ecosystems.
So, you know, when I think when a lot of people hear about the Amazon, seeing the news, you know, there's been massive deforestation, and a lot of that is to grow crops that are, frankly, to feed cattle that, you know, we eat here in the US and in other places. You know, is that true? And, you know, if so, how much do you think addressing the demand side there and actually having, you know, creating incentives for people to, you know, eat less meat and especially red meat and move to more sustainable alternatives, how much is that side of the equation something we need to focus on, as well as actually what's going on in the Amazon itself?
Mm-hmm. I think, yeah, it's all mixed together. There's a really great new group called the Amazon Investor Coalition that my friend Jonah Whitcamper has put together. And he's been running some really great numbers on kind of the potential for farmers who want to convert from kind of conventional extractive agriculture back to agroforestry, really, in a lot of cases. It's people who know this either in their lifetime or in their parents' lifetime of like living in this more agroforestry oriented way. So he's run some incredible numbers that says that we can generate another $180 billion a year out of the Amazon if we can convert the deforested area into agroforestry. So that's a huge market opportunity, $180 billion a year. And that can enable all of these farmers and communities and traditional territories and everyone to, you know, have what they need in order to thrive, including, and perhaps most importantly, a thriving ecosystem, which, you know, is not just about food or income, but also about medicine and tradition and, you know, the water cycle with the Amazon. You know, most people know of the Amazon as the world's lungs. It's also the world's heart. If you think about just all the evapotranspiration, which is, you know, trees sucking up water from the soil and putting it back into the sky. There's some estimates that says the sky rivers above the Amazon are 5 times as much water as the actual Amazon basin. And, you know, the cycle moves around the world, that water then hydrates our whole planet.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you mentioned a couple of different aspects of how Indigenous people have actually, you know, built up the soil and, you know, in some ways created, or at least fostered and stewarded, I guess, a healthy ecosystem in the Amazon. Do you think that that's kind of happened around the world, and other situations where other ecosystems where that has been more successful or less successful? Like, I guess what I'm really driving at here is that seems like a great example. And what are some other ways in which we can learn from the many millennia of historical habitation of some habitats that have recently been under pressure from anthropogenic causes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the story of the Buffalo Commons, of the, you know, American prairie that was really co-created by buffalo and Native Americans living all together with those grasslands. So, you know, it's often said that the Native Americans followed the buffalo. It was really, they were following each other in a dance that included a really healthy fire ecology, you know, amongst other things. How can we manage meadows, clear them of trees in order for the bison and other animals to be able to thrive, which then in turn helps the grasslands thrive because they've co-evolved together. And in the case of the American prairies, we actually built up, we, humanity in the long run, built up about 50 feet of topsoil. It was the largest herd that we know of in the world, 60 million plus bison or buffalo. And yeah, I think just knowing about that and specifically around the fire piece, I find so interesting. Right now, we're doing some research at BFI into Indigenous land management as it relates to fire. And you know, the world's heating up and there's going to be more fire. Mm-hmm. And the difference between investing, you know, in managing for fire and kind of, you know, doing some preventative or controlled burns or cultural burns, depending on how you want to call them, and kind of keeping that fire fuel down, versus actually paying for what it costs to clean up after a fire and lose like entire species in the process, as we did in my backyard here in the Santa Cruz area this summer. Yeah, it's just so huge. So I think we all need to kind of get a little bit more proactive around the fire. Yes, there will be lots of fire in the coming decades, and how can we see it as something to be in right relationship with and have smaller burns in order to prevent these catastrophic ones?
Yeah, absolutely. So, something you've mentioned a couple of times, I'd like to come back to and address a little more squarely. You mentioned Project Drawdown, which you were a co-founder of. Tell us a little bit more about, you know, what is Project Drawdown?
Mm-hmm. So, Project Drawdown was born in 2013 out of just a need to figure out how are we going to get there, how are we going to get to the point at which we peak in terms of our CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere and start to come back down to 350 parts per million, which is considered kind of the safe level, and ideally all the way down to 280 parts per million, which is the pre-industrial level of concentrations of CO2 in the atmosphere. And the idea was to kind of look at not just the energy side of the equation, because in that at that time in 2013, climate and energy were kind of almost one long word. People weren't talking about land sinks, ocean sinks, you know, and all that is becoming more and more popular today in terms of regenerative agriculture and forests as climate solutions. And so the idea was to create kind of, you know, a comprehensive list that included the food and land side of things, as well as materials, as well as family planning, and population, and have one big plan, essentially. So we put together an incredible research team led by Chad Frischman, and this global coalition of researchers came together and created what ended up being a New York Times bestselling book called Drawdown, and really opened up the conversation for a lot of people on how do we actually turn global warming around to global cooling. And we realized in the process that it can happen in the course of many of our lifetimes. It can happen in about 35 years or so. Our latest report for Drawdown 2020 came out and said that that drawdown could happen in 2043. And then it would take about another 10 years for temperatures to go down. So temperatures would peak in 2053 at 1.526 degrees centigrade. And so just the idea that that is possible is so, not apparent in the climate change conversation. When I was working with 350.org and Carbon War Room and some others, it's just, you know, so much of the conversation is around the future that we don't want. And if you look at cognitive biases, like the availability cascade, you know, that which you have available to you cascades into becoming reality. We really need to focus on the future that we want. So that's the core inspiration behind Drawdown. And now it's a, you know, ongoing coalition doing some really great research and communications around climate change solutions.
Thank you for that. Thank you for that summary. And just to clarify, you said that we could get to drawdown in 2043. Is that to get to 350 parts per million or 280?
No, that's just stopping going up.
That's just stopping going up. Sorry. Got it.
That's just peaking and starting to go down again. Yeah.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah.
So when you founded or co-founded Project Drawdown and that was what year was that? Sorry, that was 2013, was it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
2013. When you went through that process of identifying all the solutions and the whole team that did that, as you began to complete that process, how did your perspective shift? So what did you become more or less optimistic about our ability to succeed at solving this problem?
I kind of follow Buckminster Fuller's view on optimism and pessimism, which is kind of, you know, it's best to just be an engineer about it. Like, we have a way out. It is not likely yet because of policy and because we still haven't hardly even slowed down, even with the pandemic in terms of our emissions. And so we're still putting 40 gigatons into the atmosphere of CO2 every year. And so it's, I think of pessimism as really a luxury of a less urgent time, and optimism feels more, I don't know. I like to think of something in between that's really like, okay, we have a path, let's go. You know, our house is on fire. There's an exit path. There's no other choice than this. It kind of led me into that framing. And it's going to be weird. You know, it's, I call it the awkward era coming up. Like, the temperatures are going to continue to go up. There's going to continue to be extreme weather events and, you know, all the shocks to the system that creates. But it's really about kind of continually focusing on the future that we do want, the solutions that we do have, and how can we accelerate the deployment of those solutions as fast as possible so that we lose, you know, minimal species and minimal ecosystems and shorelines and everything that's on the edge of collapse right now.
Right. So it's sort of a forget optimism and pessimism and think about pragmatism. What can we actually do?
Yes.
Makes sense. So, you know, you mentioned we're still emitting 40 gigatons or even a little more now, despite the pandemic, despite all the reductions in travel, the reductions in economic activity. So clearly we're not very good at, as a planet, at reducing emissions. Hopefully we'll be able to get better at that in the future. What about carbon dioxide removal, CDR, as a part of this solution, especially in this time when we're still increasing emissions?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely critical. I'm, more of a fan of biological carbon dioxide removal, though I have a little bit of a hard time with that third word there because it's really an opportunity to bring this trillion tons of CO2 in the atmosphere, more carbon in the atmosphere than it has ever existed in human history, which we get to bring down into plant life and animal life, in terrestrial and ocean ecosystems. And so if we can kind of see it from that framing, I think we can get people really excited about agriculture and mariculture and forest conservation and all the things that we need to do in order to capture this trillion excess tons. So if you think about it, right now we're at about 413 parts per million concentration, and every parts per million of CO2 is equivalent to about 8 gigatons of CO2. So for every ppm is about 8 billion tons of CO2. So it's kind of like for every ppm, there's a ton of CO2 per person around the world. So if everyone had an elephant, then that would be the equivalent of every single ppm that we need to come down. So we're at 413. We need to get back down to 350, or even ideally 280. To get to 350, we need to remove about 500 gigatons, and 280 is about 1,000 gigatons, or a trillion tons of CO2. And we need to do that as fast as possible. There's so many ecosystems that are on the brink. We really don't want to play with the permafrost melting and all the methane that could come out of that, and the kind of runaway potential because of the feedback loops. So we need to remove that 1,000 gigatons as fast as possible. And we have this incredible technology that knows how to do it, which is photosynthesis, half of which right now happens in ocean ecosystems, as you know, with your work with Project Vesta, and then half of which comes in terrestrial or land ecosystems. And there's so many incredible things that happen with photosynthesis. It creates life. It takes inorganic compounds and makes them into organic or living compounds. And it provides food and fuel and fiber and flora and medicine to all sorts of animals, including us. And then it also feeds the soil and feeds sugars, those carbon sugars, and acids and enzymes and everything into the soil, which then feeds this complex living system that, in turn feeds the planet. If you think of the planet as an organism, you can think of the soil as our digestive tract. It takes in our solar income food and then makes it available in other nutrients for the rest of our organism. So I'm really, really excited about carbon sinks as they come into kind of living systems. And yeah, just thinking like there's a fire sale on carbon in the atmosphere. We have this opportunity. Get it while it's hot. Ha 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 ha.
It's interesting. It's very, very, very eloquent description of the planet. I love it. And also interesting to hear your framing here, because what I sort of took from that was, we talk about CDR, carbon dioxide removal, but that's a very sort of it's a bit of an empty term, really. And we talk about carbon sinks. I mean, it's like throw it in the sink, but what we're actually talking about is deploying this carbon into growing the global ecosystem, right?
I mean, just think about in the ocean, we have 3% left of whales of what we originally had. Think about all of the tons of carbon that gets to be whales. If it's one elephant per person per ppm, think about just all of the life that can be included in each one of those elephant equivalents per ppm. in terms of the plants, in terms of the soil microbes, in terms of just all the beautiful, beautiful restoration that we get to do in the ocean. I think oceans are really in the midst of going through a narrative shift in the climate change conversation from being kind of the damsel in distress to really being the superhero with things like Project Vesta and all of the incredible blue carbon solutions that exist, where we can, you know, really remove from the atmosphere. I guess you can use it just in looking at the whole system.
It's kind of like CDD, like carbon dioxide deployment. It's like, let's deploy it into the oceans to do something useful.
Yes. I mean, we get to literally bring the Earth back to life. How cool is that? It's such an incredible opportunity to be alive right now. I like to say there's just like karma points lying all over the place. there's so much that we get to do.
That's great. Yeah. So ocean-based solutions, you mentioned blue carbon, you mentioned Project Vesta, which of course is the project that I lead. What are you excited about in the ocean, in the ocean space?
Yeah, so we just did some good research at Buckminster Fuller Institute on blue carbon as part of our co-operating manual for Spaceship Earth, which is a big research and resource repository that we're creating, kind of like a knowledge commons or a, think of it as like a regenerative hive mind. So our first deep dive was on blue carbon. And I think the, you know, importance of conserving and just saving things like seagrass. Seagrass meadows can hold 43 times as much carbon as tropical rainforests. And, you know, if we protect them, it's kind of carbon that doesn't really go anywhere. It's anaerobic and it just kind of sits 6 meters worth of it underneath seagrass meadows. And then there's really innovative things like integrated saltwater agriculture, where we could like bring saltwater into the Salton Sea in Southern California and create, you know, all of this different agriculture and feed for cattle and, you know, grow economies based on kind of in creating these, you know, almost like bio geoengineering, creating, terraforming the Earth, as is talked about in sci-fi novels of other planets, you know, being able to do that for ourselves here. And in the process, and all of these, always trying to pay attention to how many cascading benefits can we all add up? Because I think we've made so many mistakes in the environmental movement, not looking at full systems, like, you know, looking to replace fossil fuels with palm oil and then deforesting Indonesia and causing one of the biggest climate catastrophes that's still going on today. So I think it's really important that we always look at like the full, you know, system benefits and how can we feed as many birds with one scone as possible.
Love the expression. and you know, you mentioned blue carbon. Maybe some of our listeners haven't heard that term defined before. So just you can just describe a little bit what blue carbon is.
Yeah, so it's essentially carbon in coastal and ocean ecosystems. You know, about half of the photosynthesis in the world happens in ocean ecosystems, and there's just a lot of potential there in terms of both conserving and creating healthy life in our coasts and in our ocean that will enable our ocean sinks. Again, I think it's much more complex than that and beautiful than that to be able to absorb more carbon in the coming years. And in doing so, really helping coastal communities be more resilient. So there's a lot of opportunity for our income generation, whether that's kind of, you know, shrimp farming within mangroves or the integrated saltwater agriculture I spoke to earlier, or kelp forestry, you know, with integrated mariculture, kind of like a kelp agroforestry, agro-kelp forestry, I guess it would be called. and how can we, you know, create economies around oysters and other bivalves and enable coastal communities who are going to be on the front lines everywhere because of sea level rise and extreme weather to have more resilience, you know, in their system. So if you look at kind of living systems design, there's kind of a principle that says the diversity of interactions in a system leads to more resilience and more success. And so the more we can kind of tie people to their local ecosystems, which is tied to, you know, the global ecosystem, and really help create economies with all forms of capital represented in a variety of currencies and, you know, payment for ecosystem services, then we can ensure that we have resilience.
So tell me a little bit about Buckminster Fuller Institute, some of the other programs that you all are running.
Yeah, I would love to. So Buckminster Fuller Institute is fulfilling Fuller's vision to make the world work for 100% of humanity in the shortest possible time through spontaneous cooperation without ecological offense or the disadvantage of anyone. And the way that we do our part to achieve that lofty goal and necessary goal is through a combination of programs that are education to action focused. So we have an incredible educational incubator called the Design Science Studio that's specifically for artists and creators of all sorts who are creating art and narratives around a future of possibility for life. So it's kind of a combination of futurism and art, culture creation. And we're about to have our big launch coming up. So we have 144 global artists who've been working with, who have been studying whole systems design and world building and all of these different mechanisms in order to kind of take these narratives of living systems and birth them into the world and help, you know, the conversation that often is happening at the edges really come to the middle so that everyone can tune in to our living spaceship Earth. And then speaking of Spaceship Earth, we have an online course called Trim Tab Space Camp that's for astronauts on Spaceship Earth. And we run that every other month on a variety of topics. We're about to do one on reconciliation, which is looking at truth and reconciliation processes, also reparations, also traditional ecological knowledge, and just all the different ways we can reconcile how we got here and how to get out of this mess. And then finally, as I spoke to, the Cooperating Manual for Spaceship Earth is a online repository of resources for this regenaissance, as we like to call it, that the world is undergoing. And then I also spoke to Regenerosity, which is our program to find and fund and really learn from regenerative leaders around the world and try to kind of take the solutions that we found at Drawdown and implement them in the most whole systems integrated way as possible to you know, enable cascading benefits to ensue.
Amazing work. Thank you. Thank you for sharing. And that's bfi.org if you want to go check it out. And one other question around this, do you have a professional pun writer on staff, or how does this get done?
I'm very punny. I just love wordplay. I think it helps people remember, you know, it's all fun, and also it just helps people remember concepts. And in this, you know, wild information diet that we're all in the midst of, I think play and puns can help people kind of see the light in all of the confusion of polarization and radicalization that's around. So, yeah, celebration and play, I think, are key to this whole regenaissance that we're in. And yeah, it's core to who I am too. I'm a total goofball.
Amazing, I can tell. And yeah, I mean, we might as well have fun while we save the planet, right?
Mm-hmm. We must save and savor the world at the same time.
Oh, wow, they just keep going. Another sort of issue in the oceans, of course, is ocean acidification. The mm-hmm. oceans are 30% more acidic than they were pre-industrial revolution, and that's because of all the excess carbon dioxide that we've put into the air. What's your take on how to think about ocean acidification and how to think about ocean deacidification, and what the solution set might be there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really hard to handle the ocean acidification news in terms of what it's doing to our coral. And yeah, just the ability for the ocean to continue to sustain life, which is another reason why we need to do all of this work as fast as possible, because we're really playing with fire here. It's very touch and go. So some of the best numbers that I've seen say that we'll probably only keep about 1 to 10% of our coral because of acidification and warming, the combination, and then extreme weather and species migrating and all of that doesn't help either. So overall, it's pretty tough news to stomach. And there's also some really beautiful solutions where in local areas we can deacidify through growing kelp. One of the winners of the BFI challenge, which is part of the Regenerosity Project, is called Green Wave. They do this 3D mariculture ocean farming, and they found that it deacidifies the local ecosystem by growing kelp and bivalves together with zero inputs while also sequestering carbon. So we can have these local areas of deacidification and local areas where we're also restoring the coral reefs. From what I understand with Project Vesta, some of the preliminary science says that the olivine will also deacidify the local ecosystem. So would love to see more kind of stacking of these different solutions together and kind of combined research to see what we can do in, you know, biodiversity hotspots and other places that we really want to focus on. I mean, ideally we're doing it across the entire ocean, but yeah, it's all going to require a lot of capital. I would love to see some bold moves being invested in blue carbon and ocean solutions, both for the global impact of its, you know, potential effect on the carbon cycle, but also just to preserve, you know, the beauty and the biodiversity that exists in our ocean ecosystem.
Yeah, absolutely. And definitely, you know, for those of us who, you know, who live and breathe this stuff every day, clearly we read a lot of bad news, right? And I can really hear in your voice the just the weight of all of that. So, you know, I appreciate you for sitting in that every day. It seems to me, at least, as though we're beginning to see the tide turn in terms of public opinion and political will. Certainly, of course, here in the U.S., the Biden administration has already been taking some actions, and you know, China's now come out with a net zero mid-century target. What's your take on that? Do you feel like we're starting to turn the ship around in terms of the public and political will to address this, to fund solutions, to make this happen?
Yeah, I'd say the tide's turning. I'd say it's very late in the game. You know, Buckminster Fuller talked about it being touch and go in the 70s, and yeah, I think we need to remove 1,000 gigatons, and we're still putting up about 40 every year. We've not really slowed down despite a global pandemic. It's great to hear more people talking about it, and I think we're not moving nearly as fast as we need to. That said, I think we're far more capable than we know, and Bucky talked often about we'll build all the right tools for the wrong reasons first. And so much of our technology that has been built for war and weaponry and in the name of competition, we now get to repurpose in the name of cooperation and a future where all beings thrive. And so, like, looking at satellites, you know, very much developed out of the Cold War, now taking billions of photos every year of our tree canopy and teaching us about carbon cycles to, you know, planet, taking a picture of the Earth every day and using that to protect forests and monitor corals and other things. I think we're far more capable than we know. It's just a matter of, like, going through it's not even a retooling, you know, just kind of repurposing of all the tools that we do have, including the media machine. We've seen Social Dilemma, just like the media right now is just destroying us. It's like, you know, it's like a Exxon drilling for our insecurities. Like, our anxiety is the media's fuel right now. It's like, whoa. I don't think anyone wants that. It's just the system that's been, you know, created. And so how can we flip that system over to really being a tool to remind ourselves that we can be a net positive to nature, each one of us and humanity as a whole. so that we can really turn this ship around. And I think each one of us is also more capable than we know, you know, with every decision that we make in how we eat and how we live, and what we work on, what we, you know, expend our brilliance on every day. There's this regenerative multiplier effect I like to talk about. So it's like for every action you take, if you're putting that, you know, effort, you know, your time or your treasure or your talent into a more regenerative future. So one that's kind of in tune with living systems and enabling ecosystems to increase in their potential. Then you're investing in that future, and then you're investing in people who are kind of invested in that future. And so say you're buying tomato sauce and you're deciding between the organic and non-organic. It's not just making that one decision. You're kind of putting that flow into this whole ecosystem. So the organic tomato sauce producer is paying organic farmers, and those organic farmers are paying their employees differently. And then those employees are, you know, making different purchasing decisions. So just thinking about the kind of butterfly effect of each one of our actions, I think is, can be really inspiring. And I would love everyone to feel that we actually are more capable than we know. And we can go through a step change while it is very, very late in the game. And the window of opportunity is still narrowing. It's not even widening yet. I still think we can do this, but it's about pragmatism more than optimism, as you said earlier.
Yeah, well, on those beautiful, wise, and inspiring words, I think that's the perfect moment to close. So, Amanda, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been an absolute honor and a pleasure to get to speak with you. So thank you so much.
You're so welcome. Yeah, I'll just finish with one of the insights that came out of Drawdown was that carbon as an element is an element that likes to hold hands and collaborate. It likes to link up with others. And so just, you know, let's use that as inspiration. As we are healing the carbon cycle, how can we also heal how we collaborate with one another? Use this critical moment as an incredible opportunity to heal at every level. So thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much for sharing that. And thanks for coming on the show. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thanks for listening to Going Negative, a podcast about solving climate change through carbon dioxide removal. If you enjoyed it, please share it with your friends. We hope you'll join us next time. Until then, take care.